I'm very excited about the opportunity to be here today to speak to you. Just gonna move this chair out of the way. I've been here all week, so you guys have the benefit of me having practiced this talk 5 times in the last 4 days, so I hope it'll be good. Pumping iron is a term in the United States. It means to work out. And a lot of times developers have this sense of, you know, they stick with a language they know. They're not exercising their minds, and this is an opportunity to talk about languages that are really outside the mainstream of the .NET programming world. Python and Ruby, which are the languages I'm going to talk about primarily today, have been growing in popularity in the development community at large, but they're fairly new to the Visual Studio world, to the .NET world. I'm the program manager for Iron Python. I also work very closely with the Iron Ruby team, so we're going to talk a little bit about both of those languages today. Now, some of the most important information I'm going to give you all day is on this slide. That is to say, my contact information. There's my email, there's my weblog, there's my Twitter. I'm also on Facebook and MySpace and all those other social sites. My phone number, my work phone number, is actually listed on my blog. I am very easy to find and get a hold of. If you are at all interested in these technologies and want to take advantage of them, please do not hesitate to contact me. I always joke that there's this reality distortion field that sits over Microsoft's campus in Redmond. And the only cure for that is to get out and talk to real customers, which is part of the reason why I'm so excited to be here talking to you today. So I'd like to start with a show of hands, audience participation, to get everybody working out first thing in the morning. How many people here have worked with dynamic languages? Oh, pretty good. How many people here have worked with Python? Much fewer hands. How many people here have worked with Iron Python? A couple of people. Okay, cool. These are dynamic languages, right? Python and Ruby. And this brings up the question of what is it about a language that makes it dynamic and differentiates it from, say, static languages? We had a discussion internally on the team recently about whether or not Visual Basic qualifies as a dynamic programming language. In Visual Basic, if I have a reference to an object, I can say object.sumMethod, and it will emit the call to look that method up at runtime rather than instead of doing it at compile time. Does that make Visual Basic a dynamic language? Well, kinda, right? If we go and we look at the definition of the arbiter of all knowledge, Wikipedia, and ask it what's a dynamic language, this is what it says. Dynamic programming language is a term used broadly in computer science to describe a class of high-level programming languages that execute at runtime many common behaviors that other languages might perform during compilation, if at all. These behaviors could include extension of the program by adding new code, extending objects and definitions, or modifying the type system, all during program execution. So yes, from that perspective, Visual Basic does something at runtime that languages like C# do at compile time, or it can do, right? It can emit call to say, look up this function at runtime and see if it exists. And of course, if it doesn't exist, then it will throw a runtime exception. 18 months ago, as a C# developer coming over to the Visual Studio Languages team, this all sounded very dangerous to me. Like you're hanging off the side of a cliff by only your fingernails. The idea that you wouldn't have the compiler there to enforce safety around type safety, around the existence of methods that you might want to call, that sounded very dangerous. Doing these things at runtime instead of compile time sounded very dangerous. But over the last 18 months, I've come to look at it a little bit differently. This is not a picture of my son, but I had this exact scene with him, my 6-year-old, about a month ago, when he realized that he didn't need the training wheels on his bike anymore. And so we took them off. Sure, he's more likely to fall over than he was before when he had the training wheels. But he can also take his bike in new places that he could never take it before. And that's how I think about dynamic programming languages. Yeah, it's true, right? Usually in computer science, you want to move as many things to compile time errors from runtime errors. Because compile time errors typically happen at your desk. Runtime errors happen at 3 o'clock in the morning and you get a page and wake you up from your sleep. But runtime, these kind of dynamic languages also provide very significant advantages. They're more flexible. Because they're doing these operations at runtime, they can do things that statically typed programming languages simply can't. Let me give you an example. This is Iron Ruby. This is some code in Ruby. We would normally execute it with Iron Ruby, but this is Ruby programming language code from the Ruby on Rails framework, which you may or may not have heard of. It's fairly popular and has had a lot of buzz recently. Active Record is their object relational mapper. If you're familiar with the .NET framework, it's kind of like Link to SQL conceptually. The thing that's different about Link to SQL and Active Record is this is an entire class definition in Active Record. simply declaring the existence of a class. Assuming you're following Ruby on Rails conventions of naming and the existence of a primary key named ID that's auto-increment and a few other things, when you actually execute this code in a Ruby on Rails application, it will go out to the database, it will grovel the schema, and it will update itself to match. Compare that to Link to SQL. In Link to SQL, you say, I want to create a Link to SQL object in Visual Studio, and it brings up this nice, pretty designer, and you drag the customer table from your database onto the designer surface. The reason that you have this very convenient designer is if you've ever looked at the code that gets emitted, there's about 400 lines of code for the simple act of a simple translation of one single table to Link to SQL. And we have a designer because nobody wants to write that code by hand. Now, if you have to go and change the database, in Ruby on Rails, you start and stop the application. When the application comes back up, Ruby on Rails will go out and re-grovel the database schema, and it will create the new version of customer. Compare that to Link to SQL, where you actually have two completely separate copies of your database schema, one in the database and one in code. And you have to make sure you keep those in sync, otherwise bad things happen. And believe me, modifying that model, that the link to SQL model, after you've created it, is not as simple as just dragging it onto the screen. You have to do all those updates manually. And that's a very, that's a time-consuming task. Now, this isn't to say that Ruby is better than C# or Ruby on Rails is better than Link to SQL, right? This is where you start getting into the idea of a flame war, right? Static languages are safer. Dynamic languages are more powerful. Okay, yeah, there's been a lot of gasoline spilled on the internet discussing this topic, right? I work for Microsoft. This having a flame war is of zero interest to me. I like dogs and cats living together, right? I want to be able to use these technologies together. The reality is there are some scenarios for which C# is always the right answer. But by the same token, there are some scenarios for which dynamic languages like Python and Ruby are always the right answer. And then there's this gray area in between, say 60-70% of the problems, for which both languages could be used. We have a customer in Iron Python named Resolver, and they build an Excel-like spreadsheet IDE tool. Think of Excel for developers, if you will. The idea of being able to build an application using a spreadsheet metaphor. Those guys, when they were looking around to build this application a few years ago, they wanted to pick an application. They needed a language that they could embed inside of their documents. And at the time, the only possible option was Iron Python. Then they had this wacky idea that they would maybe build the entire application in Iron Python. Well, nobody does that, right? Everybody builds, if you're building on .NET, you use C# or you use Visual Basic. But they had this idea, let's try doing it in Iron Python. We'll do some prototypes. And if it doesn't work out, we can throw them out and go back to using C#. And several years later, in like 40,000 lines of production code, they are still working almost exclusively in Iron Python. They've got 40,000 lines of code and 120,000 lines of test code. These are very hardcore test-driven development folks. And they are extremely happy with the language, and they're extremely happy with their decision. These aren't... Now, these guys have picked Python, and they're very happy with Python. Some other companies are using a little bit of Python embedded inside of a larger C# application. We'll see some examples of that as we go through further. The idea here is that .NET is a toolbox. C# is a tool in this toolbox. Iron Python and Iron Ruby are a tool in this toolbox. You can use whichever tools work best for the problem at hand. And our job in the Visual Studio Languages team is to make sure that these tools all work well together. So a couple of things about why I think Python, the scenarios in which I think Python and Ruby really shine on the .NET framework. First off, they are very easy to learn. And by extension, they're very easy to teach. I've spent all week talking to universities. So easy to learn and teach has been top of mind for these folks. But even if you're working in a normal project, how many people here are believers in agile development methodologies? Some pretty decent number of hands. In agile methodologies, one of the aspects of this often in some of these various agile methodologies is to have your programmers and your subject matter experts sitting next to each other in the project. The idea is to increase the communication between the people who understand the problem domain and the people who are going to implement the solution in the software domain. And in order to do that effectively, one of the things you have to do is you have to get your programmers to understand at least enough of the problem domain to communicate with the subject matter experts. But what about the opposite direction? What about getting subject matter experts to understand the domain of software? Right? Typically, with languages like C#, we don't do that because they're complicated. Let me give you an example. This is Hello World in C#. Well, this is Hello World if you create a standard Visual Studio templated console app. There are a lot of concepts here that you have to explain beyond the simple Hello World line. What's a using statement? What's a namespace, really? What's a class? What's a static function? What's a void? Or what's the args parameter? And then finally, what's the hello the console.writeline line? Now, the reality is the default template for Visual Studio is a little more complicated than you really need. You could simplify this, right? This is the simplest C# application you can build for Hello World. We've eliminated namespaces and using, so that's a concept we can get rid of. We still have a class. We still have a static function. We've gotten rid of the arguments, so that's something simpler. We did make our one line of code we care about a little more complicated because we now say system.console. I know this will be difficult because I assume a lot of you haven't seen Python, but maybe you'll be able to understand the Python version of Hello World. Not so fast. I'll give you 10 minutes to figure this out. No. Print Hello World. It doesn't get any simpler than that. Actually, PowerShell, it's just Hello World. It's even simpler. PowerShell is also a dynamic language, as it turns out. Print Hello World. You show me a subject matter expert, and I will show you somebody who can understand this code. It's slightly more complicated in Ruby. It's put S for put string, right? And that's an acronym, so it's slightly more complicated than just saying print, right? Now, clearly, the complexity of Hello World should be your number one priority in determining the programming language of choice. No, clearly not. But I was talking at Aalborg University on Monday about this idea of structure. And we talk about on our team this idea of ceremony. C# enforces this structure on you, right? You have to have things in namespaces. You have to have things in classes. You have to have code in functions. Now, in most applications, that structure is a good thing. If you're going to build any kind of significantly sized application, you're going to want to have things like namespaces and classes and functions to organize your code. But not always, especially when you're talking about extensibility points or things that you want to be able to communicate with subject matter experts. Maybe you just want to write some code. Maybe you just want to print Hello World to the screen. Why do I have to take on all that extra complexity if I really want to do something simple? In Python and Ruby, if you want to do something simple, you just do it. If you decide that maybe this block of code is something I'd like to call multiple times, I can then take on the additional complexity of creating a function and making that abstraction available to the developer. If I then later want to take a bunch of functions to group them together into a class, I can take on the additional complexity of a concept of a class. But I don't take those complexity concepts on until I need them, as opposed to having them forced down my throat from minute one. And that is one of the reasons why these languages tend to be so much easier to teach. I've seen examples where people have taken the C# kind of code, and they've used pound regions to say, don't look at the code, you know, all that structure code at the top and bottom of the function. Sort of like the way that the Windows Designer worked in Visual Studio 2002 and 2003. Don't look at the code in here. Don't mess with it because you'll break everything, right? You don't care about this stuff yet. In Python, that structure just isn't there if you don't need it. Sure, you can create functions. You can create classes. You can create organizational for your code in modules and packages the way that .NET has assemblies. But you don't need to if you don't want to. And that significantly reduces the amount of effort it takes to learn these languages. MIT actually recently switched over to using Python as its primary teaching language for beginning computer science classes. Now, for all this simplicity, you might think, wow, it's a great simple language for Hello World, but that doesn't mean I can do anything particularly interesting or powerful with it. And you'd be wrong. These languages are surprisingly powerful, specifically because they are dynamic. Because they are doing at runtime what languages like C# and VB do at compile time. And because they're happening at runtime, it means you can change them at runtime and accomplish these interesting tasks. Let me give you a couple of examples. Who here knows anything about aspect-oriented programming? Okay. Aspect-oriented programming is had some popularity in the object-oriented world, certainly on the Java side with AspectJ, it's been pretty decent. The thing that's interesting about this is that object-oriented programming languages are very good at decomposing nouns, things, objects, hence the name object-oriented programming. Right? We've all seen things like, I've got a car, and a car has four wheels and one engine and two doors. Right? And I can decompose that car into these separate objects and then recompose them using composition or inheritance. Object-oriented programming languages are good at that. But what they're not good at doing is decomposing action or behavior, verbs. That's typically been the traditional environment for things like functional programming languages, like F#. Python is a multi-paradigm language. It has constructs that are functional and object-oriented, and you can combine them in very powerful ways. Let me give you an example. A while back, I was trying to work with the multi-threaded libraries that are coming in .NET 4.0. And so I was doing some operations, some data crunching operations that took a long time. And I was comparing them across single-threaded and multi-threaded. So I wrote code that looked like this. I wanted to time some operations in Python, some of these Python operations. Now, there's a lot of noise here because I'm doing the same thing over and over again. Let me highlight the lines that matter. This is the logic. Everything else that isn't highlighted is an aspect. It's an aspect for timing. I'm timing these operations. I've got some stuff I want to do before and some stuff I want to do after the operation. There's no way to conveniently do that in an object-oriented programming language. So you would be stuck with code like this. And everybody here has probably written code that looks like this before. In Python, it's actually fairly easy to extract out the aspects of this, the behavioral aspects, into its own separate function. Let me give you what that looks like. So here I've defined an operation called timed_op. So this is Python code, a little harder to understand than Hello World. A couple of quick things. You'll notice that there's no curly brackets. Python uses significant white space to indicate the end, the beginning and ends of a block. So I've got a definition of a function called timed_op. It ends, that line ends with a colon, and then all the rest of the code is indented an equal amount. That indicates it's all part of the same block. You'll notice that that same code I saw in the last slide, repeated over and over, is here on this slide. Print starting, start the stopwatch, do the operation, stop the stopwatch, print the time it took to do it. Now, a couple of things to note about that. First off, fun, in this case, the variable fun, represents a function object. Functions in Python are object instances, just like integers are, just like strings are, just like class instances are. That means that I can pass them around just as easily. And it also means that they have attributes that I can inquire about, like what's your name, which is what I'm doing here. What's your name function? I'm printing starting function name. The other thing that's interesting is that I can also invoke them by using the parentheses, just like I can do a delegate, say, in C#. The star args and star star keywords are Python's equivalent of a parameter argument. Right? It's a collection of all the stuff that doesn't get automatically caught earlier in the parameter declaration. Python supports both positional and keyword arguments, which is why there's two, one for all the extra positional and one for all the keyword arguments. So I do the prologue, right, starting the stopwatch. I execute the operation. I do the finishing part, and then I return the value. So this actually acts as a wrapper around the function that gets passed in as the first parameter. And it lets me call this code, which is the equivalent of that first noisy slide that we saw. But I think we'd all agree that this is much clearer to read. And we're passing in those function objects as the first parameter. Now, sometimes, in timed operations, I usually am going to want to control when I do and don't time operations. But there are other aspects that I always want to implement. I always want to do security. I always want to log. I always want to start and stop transactions. In those scenarios, I don't want to rely on the developer knowing the right way to call the operation. What I'd like to be able to do is to say, here's a function, and here's a aspect that I want to apply to that function. So you'll bear with me for a second. I'm going to do this for timer op since we've already seen it. Chances are you would never actually do this for timer op, this specific aspect. So here I've now written a new version of the timer op function. A couple of things to note. This is a function that declares a local function, something you don't typically see in C#, but you do see in functional languages like F#. So I've got this function, this internal function called wrapper, which looks pretty much like the one we saw on the slide before last. The only difference is that fun, the fun parameter, is getting passed into the outer function. And the inner function is acting as an object that closes over that variable. Now, to call this in Python, I do this. I define my function, load logs, load games, and calc record, and I add this declaration. What does this look like in C sharp? Looks like a custom attribute. The difference between custom attributes in C sharps and decorators in Python is that C sharp custom attributes are passive. You have to actively go looking for them. They don't automatically inject behavior. But decorators in Python inject behavior. What we're actually doing here when we say time.decorator def load logs is we're defining the load logs function. We are then passing it to time.decorator. It returns an object, a function that wraps the original function, and it rebinds that to the load logs variable name. Rebinding the name of a function, that's something you can't do in languages like C sharp because C sharp isn't dynamic. This allows me to write code that looks like this. I just write the code, load logs, load game, and calc record, and the timed operation is automatically invoked. Now, again, you wouldn't do this for timing, but let me give you an example of a case where we use this internally to great power. We were building a standalone, WPF-based user experience, and we wanted to be able to invoke operations on background threads that took a long time. Right? We don't want to block the UI while it's processing in the background. Right? This is common design pattern for long-running operations, like downloading tweets from Twitter or what have you. Right? Typically, it's very difficult to do this because the user takes some action, right? Download the latest tweets. And so then you say, I want to invoke that on a background thread. And then so you spin up a background thread or you queue up a task on the thread pool. And then when it completes, you want to update the UI. But you can't update the UI from a background thread, so you have to marshal that call back to the UI thread. And this typically takes a lot of effort. In Python, we were able to build a background thread decorator and a UI thread decorator. If you adorned a method with background thread, instead of actually just calling the function, it would queue it to a background to the thread pool and execute it there. If you called a foreground thread, it would check the dispatcher, WPF dispatcher, to make sure that it's on the UI thread. And if it isn't, it would actually dispatch the call to the right UI thread. This way, in our code, we could just say, oh, here's the event handler for clicking the button. It calls this function that executes on the background task automatically. And in the background function, it would automatically call back to the UI thread. And all of the plumbing to make that work happens automatically. Decorator is a very old pattern, right? It was defined in the original, well, very old, right? I mean, in internet time, it's very old. It was defined in the original Gang of Four book. Python actually has specific syntax for enabling you to build it. And it's one of the things that's very powerful and is a very common reason for people like using Python. I use it to great extent, to great use all the time, like that UI thread and background thread example. Another place where these languages really excel is in the area of metaprogramming, right? Defining programs that write programs. So let me give you an example of this. Test-driven development is very big in the dynamic languages space. They don't have a compiler to provide any kind of basic unit testing type of operations. So there's oftentimes a significant amount of test code that gets written, or way beyond the typical type of stuff you check for in a compiler. I mentioned earlier that Resolver has, I believe it's up to 40,000 lines of production code and somewhere in the neighborhood of 120,000 lines of test code. Now, it's been suggested that the reason they need this much test code is because they're using a dynamic language. But the folks on that team have been very clear about the fact that if they were using C sharp, they'd actually need to use more test code because it's much harder to test statically typed languages than dynamic. It's very easy to build stubs and mocks in dynamically programmed languages to be able to test only specific features and specific pieces of functionality. But again, you have a very strong sense of test-driven development in the dynamic programming languages world. So here's a C sharp program that uses the Visual Studio test framework that comes with Visual Studio Team System to test the built-in stack object. You'll excuse the kind of Pythonic indenting. I did that so that we'd get it all to fit on the slides. I know you don't normally put curly braces like this. But I figured weird curly braces and bigger text was a better choice. Here's that same testing code written in Iron Ruby using a framework that my teammate John Lamb built in about 30 lines of code. It looks a lot different. I would argue that it looks much cleaner. Describe .NET stack operations, do. It should create an instance with zero elements, do. Stack.new.count, .should, .be, zero. Now, there's some things that look very strange about this compared to, say, the C# version. For example, the words describe and it look like keywords. But you'll notice I haven't highlighted them as keywords here. Right? They're white instead of blue. It's because they're not keywords. Ruby has no concept of describe or it. We'll see how those are implemented in a minute. The stack, the standard .NET stack object, has the count is a property of type integer. And anybody here probably knows that integer does not have a method called should. And finally, what's this do and end thing? That looks kind of strange. I've never seen that before in C#. In fact, this is fairly unique to Python doesn't have a concept of this either. It turns out describe is actually just a function. Here's the entire implementation of describe. It's three lines of code. Right? Describe is a function, but there's no parentheses. Ruby automatically lets you drop the parentheses if they're not, if it's clear, if it's not ambiguous. So here, I can just say describe .NET stack operations, and it automatically gets passed in. I don't have to do any extra syntax like parentheses, which makes it that much easier, which makes it that much clearer to the subject matter expert. Do and end. Do and end is, again, kind of strange if you're coming from a C# or even a Python background. In Ruby, there's this implicit anonymous function that can be passed. You can pass an implicit anonymous function to any other function. And you do that using the do and end operation. So what I'm really passing here is not a string, but a string and an anonymous function. You'll notice that the anonymous function isn't actually in the parameter array. We say describe description. We don't say describe description and some random function. We invoke the function that's passed into the describe function by calling the yield keyword. Yield here is very different than, say, C# version of yield, which is used in creating iterators. Yield here says, I want to invoke that implicit function that was passed into me. If I wanted to, I could define parameters for that implicit function, but we haven't done that in this case. It, like describe, is implemented the same way, right? It's just another function. Hold on a second. Again, it takes a description and this implicit block of code, which it then executes by calling yield. I'm not highlighting it because it works exactly the same as describe. And then finally, we have the function, we have the method should be. So this is a stack object, a standard .NET stack object, which has a property called count. By the way, you'll notice here that count is lowercase. In Ruby, the naming convention, Ruby is a case-sensitive language like C#, but the typical convention is to use lower cases and underscores rather than Pascal or camel casing the way it is in .NET. So in order to make things friendlier for the Ruby developer, we actually translate those calls automatically for them. So this is a call to the standard stack.count property. We're creating an extension called should. Now, if you're a C# developer, you might be familiar with extension methods because we introduced those in C# 3.0. The difference here is that in C# 3, extension methods are a syntactical sugar. It allows me to define a static function and allows me to call it object.should rather than should left parenthesis object. If I walk up to the standard .NET object and say, do you implement a method called should, the answer is no. In Ruby, we're actually modifying the base object class. So after I make this call, I can walk up to object and say, do you define a method called should, and it will say yes. Should returns this positive expectation object, and we've implemented a function on it called b. B takes a single parameter. Again, we can drop the parentheses when it's clear. And all this is doing is comparing the intrinsic value that was passed in to positive expectation in the constructor to the value that was passed in as an argument. Fairly straightforward. I could have defined the equals equals operator here instead. So I could have said count.should equals equals 3. And in fact, in most decent scale Ruby test frameworks, they do both. But I wanted to build something that would be simple enough to fit on the slides. Ruby has several very extensive testing frameworks that work basically like this, are more featured than this. This is 30 lines of code, which makes it very easy to describe in a few minutes in a presentation like this. I would never use this framework for any real testing. I would use something like RSpec or Bacon, which are commonly used testing frameworks in the Ruby community. But again, they work basically like this. They have a describe function and they have an init function. They don't just automatically echo the results to the console. They do more complicated things that allow them to be able to save results to a text file and do that kind of stuff. But the basic concepts work the same. So these are some very powerful techniques that you can use in Python and Ruby. And as Spider-Man likes to say, with great power comes great responsibility. There's this phrase in the Python community that metaprogramming should be ignored by 99% of the community. And that may be true. But it's that 1% of the community that can build tools like Ruby on Rails. Right? Ruby on Rails, in popularity, has soared in the last few years because it's an extremely easy framework to use. And it's an extremely easy framework to use because they embrace some of these kind of powerful techniques. So even if the 1% builds it, the 100% of the community can actually use it. Now, so great. Python and Ruby, fantastic languages. I can go out and use IronPython and IronRuby, or I can also use the original versions that are implemented in C. So what's the incentive to use IronPython and IronRuby? These are first-class .NET citizens. I can use Python and Ruby on both the desktop and the Silverlight versions of the common language runtime. So I can build Python and Ruby code that runs on the desktop, that runs in the server, and runs in the browser. Across platform, Windows, Mac, and with Moonlight Linux, and across browser, i.e. Firefox, Chrome, Safari, and I think Opera. I'm not 100% sure about Opera. So what does this look like? First off, we can interoperate with statically typed .NET code, which is to say the vast majority of .NET code that's out there that's written in C# or Visual Basic. Here's a very simple example. This is code to download the RSS feed from my weblog and spit out all of the titles. How much effort do you think the system.xml team put into IronPython compatibility? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Zero. IronPython didn't exist until 2004. The original version of system.xml shipped in 2002. So there's no way they could have possibly given any consideration to IronPython. We can just work with the vast majority of existing .NET code. The only code we don't work with is stuff that requires the existence of a static type. For example, in WCF, you define a contract by defining a type. And you add custom metadata to it. We can't do that in Python, because in Python, we don't build static types. We've actually got a feature in the new version of Python, so you could sort of do that, but it takes a lot of effort. Outside of the areas where you need a static type, Python works fantastically, and like this. So let's walk through a couple of things in this piece of code. First off, we're importing a module called CLR. The CLR module is a custom module in IronPython where we hide all of the IronPython-specific behavior. All the other modules that you'll access in Python are either A, .NET classes, like we're doing here with XML, or B, standard Python modules. We add a reference to the system.xml assembly. Now, typically in C#, what you'll do is you'll right-click on Add References dialog box, wait a couple of minutes, and then you'll click on system.xml. And that reference is embedded in the metadata of the compiled application. We don't have a compiled application in Python, typically. We only have the script file that we're executing, so we have to do it imperatively rather than declaratively. Then we import XML document. The from import is kind of like using in C#. The difference is that it's not optional. As we saw in the Hello World example, if I don't want to use the using statement, I can type out the full type name, system.console.writeline. In Python, you have to import the types you want to use. If you just say import system.xml.xmldocument, you have to continue to use the full type name. This format, from system.xml import xmldocument, allows me to use just the short type name, as you can see further down. I then create an instance of the XML document. You'll notice the lack of the word new. In Python, you create a new instance by calling the type as a function. This is the biggest problem for me going back and forth between C# and Python. Right? I'll type XML equals XML document left parenthesis and expect the IntelliSense to come up and be like, oh, I forgot new. Back. New XML document left parenthesis. Ah, IntelliSense. But then everything else that's in the code here is pretty much standard XML document-y type stuff. I call XML load. I call XML select nodes. I iterate over the items list. 4 in Python is the equivalent of 4 each in C#. Otherwise, it's pretty much the same. When you type XML.load, we're using the underlying reflection infrastructure of .NET to say, you know, object XML, do you, you know, invoke the member load with the parameter HTTP feeds, feedburner, devhawk. That's what allows us, this rich metadata infrastructure of CLR is what allows us to interoperate with almost all existing .NET code. Now, this works great going from Python or Ruby to C# or VB. But traditionally, it has not been anywhere near as easy to go the other way. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. Here's how one talks to statically typed objects in C# today. I have a class called calculator. I'm going to call its add function with 2 parameters, 10 and 20. Right? The answer is 30 in case you get... No, just kidding. In this example, the C# compiler at compile time will determine to make sure that there is actually a class called calculator out there, that getCalculator returns a type of that class, and that class has a method on it called add that takes 2 integers and returns an integer. That's all validated at compile time. If you want to do this stuff at runtime, you can write code that looks like this. This is the equivalent code to the top example, but now written in reflection. If you do this in Visual Basic, if calc is an object type, you can actually say, you know, object.add, and it will actually emit something similar. VB also has a bunch of stuff to be able to bind against COM objects, so it has its own implementation rather than using core reflection like this. But it's similar conceptually. Now, if I wanted to do this in Python, I'd have to write code that looks like this. I have to get the calculator as a scope. I then ask the scope to give me an add function, which just comes back as a Python variable. And then I ask the Python engine to invoke that parameter and pass in to invoke that function and pass in the parameters. And then I convert the result, because it comes back as an object, I convert that to an integer. If I'm running C# that runs in the browser and I want to interoperate with some JavaScript, I have to write code that looks like this. I get the calculator object to something called a script object. I then call invoke, which looks a little bit like the invoke from reflection, but not exactly. I pass in the name, and I pass in the arguments. And again, I convert the result back to an integer. The C# team starts to see that, hey, there's a lot of these type of dynamic operations are getting done. Maybe we should implement something in the language to make this simple. And that's what we're doing in the next version of C#. So these slides come from Anders Hausberg's deck at PDC 2008 last year. We've introduced this new keyword, dynamic. So I call dynamic, I get the calculator object as a dynamic object, and I call calc.add. This looks a lot like that first version of the code that we saw, the statically typed version. But there's some very significant differences. First off, this is statically typed to be dynamic. I could make a joke here about the mental gymnastics it takes to do static typing, but no, just kidding. Dynamic is a alias for object, right? So when you look in the metadata, this is of type object, the calc is. But dynamic sort of sets a flag that indicates to the underlying infrastructure that I want to opt in to the new dynamic dispatch model of the dynamic language runtime, a new framework that we sort of extracted from the work we did on Iron Python, and is included in the box in Visual Studio 2010 and .NET Framework 4. So by using the word dynamic, we're saying we want to use dynamic dispatch to separate it from, say, object, which means we don't, which is, of course, means we need to do that for compatibility with all the existing C# code that's out there. That means that when you type calc.add, this method is invoked at runtime and is validated at runtime instead of compile time. If I type calc. This function doesn't exist, the C# compiler will happily compile that. And when you go to run it, we'll throw a runtime error saying, this function doesn't actually exist that you tried to call. When you bring up IntelliSense, it will do a little box. When you say calc dot, it brings up the IntelliSense window and says, this is a dynamic object, so I can't give you any IntelliSense. But of course, customers expect the IntelliSense to show up when they type the dot, so we had to put something up there. The other important thing to notice is that we actually dynamically convert when we do the assignment. We don't have to cast this to an integer. We don't have to manually call convert on it. We implicitly do that when we assign a dynamic type to a static type. The DLR implements a variety of standard protocol operations, like invoke, like get and set member, and what have you. One of the ones we implement is convert. So we can actually ask the object itself, convert. And this way, the actual underlying infrastructure of the object model can determine the best way to convert this type to, in this case, an integer. It doesn't matter whether calc is a C-sharp type, and we're talking to it via reflection, if it's a JavaScript type and we're talking to it via the JavaScript infrastructure of Silverlight, or if it's a Python object and we're talking to it via IronPython. We write the same code. And that is a huge step forward, and we're very excited about it in IronPython and IronRuby, because this allows the mainstream .NET programming languages, C-sharp and VB, to be able to interoperate with IronPython and IronRuby as easily as we can interoperate with them. Another aspect about these languages is how easy they are to extend. If you want to, a very common pattern in these dynamic languages is to build some code in Python or Ruby, and if it's not fast enough, take the part where the hotspots are and rewrite those in C. This is non-trivial. This is an example of an extension to Python written in C. I know you can all read this very quickly. I know you had a hard time with Hello World, but this is very obvious. No, I'm just kidding. There's a couple of things I want to point out in here. It's hard to see them, but you've seen PyType, PyString, PyIncref, and PyDecref. If you've done any COM programming, you're probably having flashbacks right now. The reason why you have to write all of this code is because Python and C live in very different worlds. Python has a reference counting garbage collector. C, not so much. Right? Python has an existing type system. C's type system is different. So in order to make these two work together, you have to do a ton of work in C to make C integrate into the view of the world that Python has. Here's that exact same code written in C-sharp and usable from IronPython. It's not very difficult. It's just a simple class with a couple of public fields and a public constructor that sets them. How much Python-specific code do we see here? None. Just like system.xml. We don't have to do anything special to our C-sharp code to make it work with IronPython or IronRuby. It just works. Because we're executing all of this stuff in the same execution environment, the common language runtime. This is a much more convenient view of the world than the view of the world that CPython and CRuby have. It's one of the reasons why we have such rich interoperability between C-sharp and VB. The common language runtime was designed for that kind of interop, and it makes our lives significantly easier. Another scenario we see a lot of with Python and Ruby is this idea of embedding. We talked about the resolver customer, our customer resolver earlier. Resolver picked IronPython because they needed an embeddable programming language. A programming language where I can just type some text and stick it in a file or stick it in the database or get it out of a config file or get it from somewhere and execute it. This turns out to be very easy to do with Python and Ruby. It's really only about four lines of code at the simplest level. In this example, I'm assuming that my app.config file has information about what languages are available to me. This code is language neutral. We actually have a standard hosting API that we use in Python and Ruby. So I can say, read the configuration from the config file, create me a new script runtime, and then get an engine via its name. You could imagine a way of being able to show the user, here's a list of all of the possible languages you can use. Please pick the one you want to use. Or I'll embed that in the file, or I'll embed that in the database, or whatever. And then we can just execute code. This is a very simple one, right? Executing 2 plus 2. But as you can imagine, we can have a very, very complicated, much more control over how we execute code. For example, if we want to have security on this user-entered code, we can actually set up a remote app domain and create our script scopes that run in those remote app domains and control them remotely. And we've got an API for doing that in a very easy fashion. Now, if you don't care about language neutrality, if you just say, I just care about Python or I just care about Ruby, it's actually even simpler. I can actually ask the Python runtime, create an engine. Or I can ask the Ruby library, create an engine. And then I can just execute that code directly. Now, this, again, this is the very simplest way you can interact with these APIs. There are much more complicated interactions that you can have, so you can have complete and utter control over the execution of that code. But you don't have to start with that. You can start with something very, very simple. And we've seen customers that are very interested in this. I actually spoke to a customer last week who's moved all of their configuration from their own custom checkbox kind of thing to Python. And they just load it out of the database and execute it. And it gives them much more flexibility, and it's much easier for them to do. Microsoft is actually embedding IronPython in a version of, I know that this was originally the Navision headquarters, and so I really should know this. I don't know which version, which of the various Dynamics applications it is off the top of my head. But we're actually embedding IronPython in a version of Dynamics that's targeting state and local government. State and local government oftentimes has very complicated fee structures that are in no way standardized across municipalities. You want to land at the municipal airport, here's the fee structure. You accidentally pulled a fire alarm, this is the fee structure. And they're very complicated. And so what those guys are doing is they're actually embedding IronPython so that they can script what the fee structure is in a very simple language. And they don't have to build that language, they can just use Python. So we're very excited to see an actual Microsoft product embedding IronPython inside of it. We don't give you the source code to Dynamics, so our team actually went out and embedded IronPython and IronRuby inside of an application known as Witty. It's an open source Twitter application. Of course, everything today is Twitter applications. You'll notice that there's some buttons at the top of Witty. It says options and refresh. Those are standard buttons. There's also a button marked console. Pushing the console button opens up this window here on the left. The window on the left is a colorizing rich text box where you can type in code and execute it. Kind of works a little bit like the way SQL Management Studio works. It's just a text field, but I can highlight, hit Control Return, and execute the code. Now, it turns out that Witty is not very well designed for having a console injected into it. You'll notice there that second line of code, we get the list of replies, and it's twitterlib.tweet, twitterlib.tweet. They haven't implemented toString, which makes it not very friendly to a REPL-style developer like this. REPL, by the way, meaning read, eval, print, loop. Right? I've got this interactive console, and I'm interacting directly with the running application, as opposed to compiling it and debugging it, which is the more C-sharp traditional way. Now, what we'd like to be able to do is to see those guys implement some things in their infrastructure, in their code, to make it a little more friendly for interactive development, and we're actually in talks with them to do that. So this would mean that you'd actually get a much friendlier response when you said t.getReplies. The URL for this is there at the bottom. It's a very long, complicated URL. It points to my teammate Jimmy's weblog. So you can get to it from tinyurl.com/REPLWitty. If you want to do this, it's not a lot of code. Four lines of code. This is the actual event handler for the console button. Now, it's a short amount of code because we've implemented a lot of this work for you. We already wrote that console window and the text box, the colorizing executing code text box that sits inside of it. All you do in this case is create an instance of the console window, add references to some external objects. When you're executing code in this interactive environment, if you say T, we mean this built-in Twitter object, which is part of the API, the internal API of Witty. If you use the capital U, that means the Witty window. So I can move the window around and log in and log out, or I can talk directly to the Twitter API and get replies and make posts and stuff like that. We have this code. There's a reference to where this code is downloadable on the last slide, the REPL Witty tiny URL. So the point here is that I'm a big C-sharp fan, right? I switched to C-sharp within minutes of PDC 2000 being done, right? I mean, I have been a C-sharp developer as long as you could be if you weren't a member of the C-sharp team or the .NET Framework team. But over the course of the last 18 months, I've really begun to realize that there are some scenarios for which C-sharp just doesn't work very well. You can't easily embed a development environment for C-sharp inside of an end-user application. That's what Python really excels at. You can't do test-driven development as effectively on statically typed languages as you can on dynamic languages. The nature of these languages is just different. And so what I like to say is, look, there are some scenarios for which C-sharp is the obvious choice. There are other scenarios for which dynamic languages like Python and Ruby are the obvious choice. And in between, use whatever makes you feel happy, right? Dogs and cats living together. My goal is to make you as happy and productive on the Microsoft platform as you can possibly be. If you're happy in C-sharp, mostly, and then you just use Python and Ruby for the things that you just don't do well in C-sharp, that's great. If you want to write your whole application in Python the way that Resolver guys do, sure, that makes me personally happy as the program manager of IronPython. But as a Microsoft stockholder, it doesn't matter to me. All I care about is that you're happy and productive on our platform. So I want to talk about a couple of other interesting things about Python and Ruby, and then I'll take questions, and we'll go from there. First off, these languages and the underlying dynamic language runtime are open source. You'll notice I'm using the official open source logo with the trademark and everything from OSI. That's because IronPython, IronRuby, and the DLR are all officially recognized open source projects as per the definition of open source given by the OSI. The Microsoft public license has been officially recognized as an open source project, as an official open source license by the OSI. And that's the license that IronPython, IronRuby, and the DLR are all available under. All this code is available up on the website, and we actually update it very regularly. The DLR updates about once a week. Python and Ruby, usually every couple of days, sometimes multiple times a day. Now, by the way, when we say open source here, we are meaning mostly the textbook definition of open source, which means you can have the code. I realize that the generally accepted definition of open source means you can have the code and you can submit contributions back. And we don't really do that today. There's IronPython takes no contributions. The DLR takes no contributions. In IronRuby, we actually take contributions to the libraries, the compatibility with the standard implementation of Ruby. If you sign a contributor agreement, you can actually submit code that we will include in the project, you know, assuming it passes the test and it works correctly. We are slowly but surely being more open. Just yesterday, Microsoft announced the formation of the CodePlex Foundation, a nonprofit foundation for driving the use of open source in commercial companies like Microsoft. We founded it, but it's a separate organization. The current interim board of directors includes several Microsoft people, but it also includes two luminaries from the open source community, Sean Walker from the .NET Nuke project and Mikhail DeCasia from the Mono project. We are very serious about this foundation. And as you can imagine, it's something I'm personally extremely excited about going forward. It's just started literally yesterday, so there's not a ton of information out there. But just from the initial response I've seen from the community in the last 24 hours, or less than 24 hours really, the community is very excited about it, and I think that there's a lot of potential there. So a couple quick things about the roadmap, and then I want to show you a few demos. We shipped IronPython 2.0 back in December. We are on the verge of shipping our next version, 2.6. We're actually cutting the release candidate the Tuesday after I get back, next Tuesday. As you can tell, we operate on a very different cycle than the rest of Visual Studio. Right, those guys shipped their preview release back in November, and you know, we're going to ship our final. We'll have shipped an entire product cycle in the time it took for them to go from preview to beta 2. Granted, Visual Studio is slightly bigger and has a few more employees involved than IronPython. Our 2.0 version was our version of Python 2.5, and it's built on the dynamic language runtime. Right, so this was this first version. We built the original version of IronPython, and then we started to extract things from that implementation that would be useful across other languages. And that's what we call the dynamic language runtime, and part of that code is in the box in .NET Framework 4.0. We're on the verge of shipping Python 2.6. This is our version of Python 2.6. As you can see, we've changed our numbering scheme so that we can stop saying things like, IronPython 2.0 is the same as Python 2.5. We've got some very, very significant features beyond 2.6 language compatibility. We have a new adaptive compiler. It turns out that IronPython is very fast on areas that involve things like memory access and areas where compiling code beats interpreted code. One of the areas where interpreted code beats compiled code is on startup. Our startup time compared to CPython is pretty bad. So one of the things that we've done in 2.6 is we actually now have an interpreter for expression trees, which is sort of the internal representation of code in the dynamic language runtime. That means that the first time you run a piece of code, we'll actually interpret it rather than compile it. Because if you're only going to run it once, you're actually better off interpreting it than you are compiling it and running it. If you run it a few times, and I forget the specific heuristics, then we'll actually take the time to compile it on a background thread. And then we'll patch the foreground function, and when the time comes for you to call it again, you'll get the compiled version instead of the interpreted version. This interpreter is available to all languages that build on top of the DLR. It's just a question of opting into it. IronPython is doing it, and IronRuby, as we'll see here in a minute, has made some great performance gains over the course of the last year, and part of that comes from their startup time performance comes from the use of the adaptive compiler. We also have a lightweight debugger. You've been able to debug Python, IronPython, you know, pretty much since the beginning of IronPython, but it uses the full-blown CLR debugger, which means you actually block the entire process when you hit a breakpoint. It's somewhat difficult to build an extensible and yet debuggable application if your host application is blocked when you hit a breakpoint in your script. So if you wanted to do this kind of stuff with the existing version, you have to actually run your debugger separately from your script execution, and that gets pretty complicated. We now have a lightweight debugger so that we can debug just the Python code rather than the entire process. I can even debug one set of, if I have multiple things of Python running, I can actually implement the debugger on just one at a time. So I can debug this script code without having to debug that script code. We haven't implemented this in IronRuby yet, but again, it's an opt-in model. We'll be able to do that at some point. The reason we haven't done it in Ruby is that the standard Ruby library doesn't have that concept where it is there in the Python language. We've implemented C-types, which is a standard Python module. If you're familiar with .NET, C-types is Python's equivalent of p-invoke. It allows me to call into unmanaged DLLs and unmanaged endpoints and access that from Python. We're very excited about this because this, we think, will help us improve our compatibility with CPython and its use of unmanaged DLLs. Finally, I mentioned earlier that we don't interoperate very well with .NET methods that require a static type. We have this new very low-level feature called CLR type metaclasses, which allows you to completely control the layout of the .NET class that underlies your Python class. And when I say very low-level, I mean it. It is a reflection.emit-based API. We do not expect users to use this API. We expect to build a higher-level API on top of this low-level hook. But we had to build the low-level hook first. As I mentioned, this is on the verge of shipping. IronPython for .NET 4.0. We have been shipping a version of IronPython with every public beta of Visual Studio 2010. We did this for preview. We did this for beta 1. We will do this for beta 2. We will do this for release candidate. And we will do this for RTM. Approximately 1 to 3 months after RTM, we will ship our final RTM version of IronPython for .NET Framework 4.0. This works with that new C# dynamic keyword and the new support for dynamic dispatch in VB10. And we're going to support both Python 2.6 and 3.1. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Python community, those guys are undergoing a very interesting change right now. Their 3.0 version is explicitly not backwards compatible with their 2.x branch. They took the opportunity to clean up the language and to remove some constructs that they felt shouldn't be there anymore. As such, as you can imagine, adoption has been fairly slow. So we're very excited because we'll actually be up to date once we ship IronPython 2.6 with the version of Python that most people actually use. We've been chasing Python for a very long time, so the idea that we've actually caught up is very exciting. And shipping 3.1 is actually fairly straightforward because it's mostly taking stuff out of 2.6. We're going to have an opportunity over the course of the next 6 to 12 months to focus on performance, reducing our backlog of bugs, and improving our app compatibility. Because the next version of Python, the 2.7 and the 3.2 versions, are probably not going to be out for at least 12 months from now. So it gives us a window to do some very interesting things. We're very excited about it. IronRuby, not as mature a product. We announced it in 2007. In 2008, at RailsConf, we hit what we like to call the Rails singularity. we were able to run a Hello World app in Ruby on Rails. Now, this doesn't sound that impressive, but the Ruby community was very doubtful of our ability to do this in a timely fashion. Ruby is a GPL product, and therefore we do not look at the code to Ruby. And the Ruby community, especially the JRuby community, the version of Ruby that runs on the Java VM, which does, in fact, look at the Ruby code, was very doubtful of our ability to accomplish this in a short time. And we were able to do it in about a year from when we announced. Our performance in iRuby has been pretty pitiful. As you can see, back in March when we released version 0.3, we were 10 times slower on startup, and we were 4 or 5 times slower even when we were up and running. The version we released last month, version 0.9, was 2 times faster on the Ruby benchmark suite than the standard version. MRI is Matt's Ruby interpreter. That's the C-based standard version of Ruby. We've also improved our startup time significantly because of the use of the adaptive compiler. We are driving towards shipping iRuby 1.0 sometime this fall. So with that, let me just give you the URLs. IronPython lives on codeplex.com. IronPython.codeplex.com. We have a public bug database. We have all the source code. We also have a mailing list that you can join. As an open source project, we're not PSS supported, so all of the support is done through the mailing list. But we've got a fantastic community, both our developers and our internal team, and the external team is always there ready to help. There's actually this fantastic book, Iron Python in Action, recently came out. It's written by Michael Ford of Resolver Systems. He is our Microsoft Iron Python MVP today, our only Iron Python MVP, as it turns out so far. Hopefully that will change soon. If you're interested in iRuby, those guys have also a CodePlex site. They also have their code up on GitHub, but their main site with their main wiki is on ironruby.net. So with that, I want to take a quick couple of seconds and show you a few demos of some cool things that you can do with IronPython and IronRuby. One of the areas we spend a lot of time talking to customers about with IronPython and IronRuby is their use in Silverlight. If you're a Python or Ruby developer, if you're a Ruby developer, you're almost assuredly building web apps. If you're a Python developer, there's scientific computing, there's gaming, there's scripting, there's education, but web apps are also a very significant part of that community. So you're building Python or Ruby on the server, but in the client you're having to build JavaScript. Wouldn't it be great if you could build your client application, your browser-based application, in the same language you build your server side? This is the same story we tell like ASP.NET C# developers, right? Program Silverlight in C#, program the server in C#. This is an application that was built by Michael Ford called TryPython, trypython.org. You can go up and hit this site anytime you want. This is the standard Python tutorial translated over to run inside of Silverlight. So you can see here I have an interactive console, so I can print Hello World. It automatically colorizes, and I can execute. If I don't want to type all that code, I can actually just hit this button over here, and it will actually, you know, embed that directly into the console. This is an example of an interactive-style application, yet it's running completely in the browser. This was inspired by an application called TryRuby. TryRuby, the original version of TryRuby, you would type into the browser, and it would send it back to the server where it would execute it, and then it would send the results back to the user. Here we're running entirely in the browser. If I was offline, it would all continue to work. We've actually implemented a version of the Ruby tutorial. If you go to ironruby.net/tutorial, you can get to the IronRuby tutorial, which includes both an IronRuby-specific tutorial plus the original TryRuby tutorial, again designed to work in the browser. Oops. I actually have to be able to type it correctly. Right? I guess I have to type in Jimmy correctly, and I can learn about Ruby. So both of these sites are fantastic for learning how to program in Python and Ruby. Now, the reality is, if we go back to this TryPython application, we look at the source code to it, one of the benefits of web-based applications, view source, we will see that we have this Silverlight div, if you know anything about Silverlight, and we have, app.zap, right? We have a zip file that has all of the Python code, all of the DLR code, and the actual Python application code that runs this TryPython application. TryRuby is also similar. Of course, this is a very different model for programming web applications than web developers are used to. They're used to embedding all of this stuff directly in the browser script, in the HTML script. So it turns out there's this very interesting project from developer and platform evangelism called Gestalt. And the idea of Gestalt is to have inline XAML, inline Python, and inline Ruby directly in your application. So here is a very, this is one of their sample apps, so I take no responsibility for this. This is a simple application, and I'm going to say, you know, hello, Denmark. And I hit the button, and it will say, hello, Denmark. Very exciting. I know you are all extremely impressed. Actually, the impressive part of this is this, view source. So you'll notice this is not HTML. This is XAML. So they took the XAML design for that mushroom thing. They did that in Expression Blend. They copied it, and they pasted it directly into the HTML file, including things like animations and whatnot. Of course, you would never write this code by hand. You would use a tool like Expression Blend. But the really cool thing is here at the bottom. That's not JavaScript. That's Python embedded directly in the browser. So the onClick function is implemented in Python, and the completed and all of the wiring up, it's all done in Python. The way this works is that if you go back to the top, there you see a reference to jQuery, this sort of industry standard for DOM interaction in JavaScript. And then we have a JavaScript file called Gestalt. Gestalt sets up this default Silverlight environment. It will automatically grovel your HTML page looking for XML tags marked marked XAML, or looking for script tags marked Python and Ruby, and execute them in the scope of the Silverlight app. So it takes this code that's got embedded in the page and runs it inside of Silverlight. We love this model. This was actually the original model for building applications in Iron Python and Iron Ruby and Silverlight. So we're actually going to be supporting a similar model in for our Silverlight-based development by the time we reach final version of Iron Ruby later this fall. We'll also support it for Iron Python as well. So this really gives you a sense of some of the powerful things that you can do with Iron Python and Iron Ruby in the browser. The last thing I want to quickly show you is this homepage, CodePlex Foundation. Again, this is around the exchange of code and understanding between commercial software companies and open source communities. It's, in my opinion, it is a huge step for Microsoft, and I'm very, very excited about it. And one of the ways that this thing is going to work is if people inside and outside of Microsoft participate. So you'll notice there's this big participate button. I recommend you go get a chance to visit the site and look into getting involved. Again, regardless of whether you work for Microsoft or not. So with that, go back to my slides here. Just put them back up. I can take some questions. Otherwise, thank you very much for having me. It's been great for me to be in Denmark all week, and I've really enjoyed my time here. So thank you. Question.
You mentioned that these languages will become or are first-class citizens of the .NET framework. Are there any plans of shipping them together with Visual Studio, or will there be add-ons?
So the question is, are there any plans for shipping them with Visual Studio? So there's two parts to this question. The first is, will Microsoft build Visual Studio integration for these languages? And today, we do not have a very good story for that. There's a sample application which ships with the Visual Studio SDK that integrates Iron Python into Visual Studio. However, it's a very old version of Iron Python. I believe it's version 1.1. So here we are about to ship 2.6, and they're still shipping 1.1. The good news is that they are updating that SDK sample for .NET for Visual Studio 2010. So when you get Visual Studio 2010, that SDK will include an updated version of that sample that will be working on the latest bits of Iron Python. Beyond that, there's been actually a lot of interest in the community around Iron Python development tools. Today, you can actually program Iron Python with Sharp Develop, with Eclipse PyDev, and with Wing, which is a Python IDE. And it's not gone unnoticed among my management that today there are, you know, some of our biggest competitors can program Iron Python, and yet you can't really do it well on top of Visual Studio. In fact, currently the biggest open unresolved bug on Connect is lack of Iron Python integration. Michael added that bug and sort of got the community to vote it up. There's like 120 votes for it right now. So we have no specific plans, but it's something I really hope to do. It's something I believe is very important, especially now with the addition of the dynamic keyword. If you know, this is an opportunity to really be able to use these languages together. But in order for the .NET community to be able to do that, they really need, you know, decent Python integration into Visual Studio. The other aspect of this question is, will it ship in the box? And my typical answer to that is, I hope not. I mentioned earlier, you know, we're shipping our major release, and it's only taken us 10 months. Visual Studio is not on the same cadence as the Iron Python team. So the last thing I want to do is to, you know, bog Iron Python down with that level of, you know, with their cadence. If they would like to move to a 10-month cycle, we'd be fine with it, but I don't think that's going to happen. However, one of the great things about the new version of Visual Studio is that there's this website called Visual Studio Gallery, and there's direct integration in the new version of Visual Studio. So you'd be able to go into Visual Studio and say, I want to add an add-in. I type in Python. You know, this doesn't work yet, but this is what I'd like to see. Type in Python, and it would automatically download and install it. So that's the model that I'd like to move to. I'd like to have production quality Visual Studio integration, but I'd like to ship it on Gallery so that we can continue to be on our own faster cadence than a product like Visual Studio can hope to achieve. I mean, Visual Studio is on the right cadence. It's obviously a big, important product for Microsoft. It makes like $1 billion. You don't build a product like that and ship a whole new version every 10 months. That being said, I want to make sure that Iron Python continues on its cadence. Answer your question?
Yes.
Cool. Other questions? I always get the Visual Studio questions, so that's, I was expecting that. Yes? Okay, so what about security? It seems kind of dangerous. We can execute all this code in the browser. Iron Python is security transparent, which is code for, that makes Harry's life a lot easier because I have a much easier time with the Secure Windows Initiative workflow that every product at Microsoft goes through. That reduces my workload, makes me very happy. Security transparent means that we have no impact on security. We are explicitly marked as saying we do not impact any security. So we do not make security any worse, right? If you can't do something in the browser, that we still depend on the existing browser security model. So the things that you can do in Iron Python, you can still do. I mean, there's nothing there you can't do in C Sharp. I mean, Python's implemented in C Sharp. So if you can do it in C Sharp, you can do it in Iron Python and vice versa. So it doesn't actually introduce any new security problems from that perspective. If you want, I don't know enough about how the browser model works for app domains, but at least on the desktop, if I want to create a lockdown, like for example, Python has a top-level function for opening files. You might imagine that you'd like to run a script but disallow the ability to open files from it. In that case, you can build a remote app domain. I don't know if this works in Silverlight. I don't know the Silverlight model for app domains. But I can build an app domain on the desktop, disallow its file access, and run my code in there. And if the user calls open, then it will fail and say, you don't have the right security permissions. Does that answer your question? It does introduce the possibility for runtime errors, right? That's the thing about using a dynamic language. But it doesn't introduce any kind of potential security problems. Other questions?
Are extra runtime libraries necessary to, I guess, the DLLs are just intermediate language after the compiler created them. So can you run them off a standard .NET box when deploying them? Or?
Yes, they are. OK, so the question is, are there any additional assemblies needed? So the Iron Python in 2.6 has several DLLs, right? So the Iron Python implementation itself is two DLLs, Iron Python and Iron Python modules. Iron Python is the core runtime. Iron Python modules is an implementation of the binary libraries that ship with CPython. So the standard Python comes with its own standard library, much like C Sharp comes with the base class library. So some of those are implemented in Python, and some of those are implemented in C. So we ship C Sharp version of the C libraries from Python. For the Python-based modules, we actually just include those in the box. So we actually redistribute the Python standard library, the Python parts of the Python standard library, in the box with Visual Studio, in the box with Iron Python, though that's an optional. You don't have to use them if you don't want to. If you're more familiar with the Python libraries, you can use them. If you're more familiar with the .NET ones, like I am, I tend to use the .NET equivalents rather than the Python, just because I know them. There's also a set of DLLs that make up the DLR. Today, those DLRs are the Microsoft Scripting Core, which is essentially the version of System Core that will ship in .NET Framework 4. So this is the core part of the DLR. We obviously don't have that on .NET Framework 2, so we have to include that. That'll be in the box in .NET 4, so you won't have to include that in IronPython. We also have a bunch of other reusable code that we share between Python and Ruby, which we call Microsoft.scripting. We have the lightweight debugger, Microsoft.scripting.debugger. If you're building Silverlight, we have a common Silverlight hosting model between Python and Ruby, Microsoft Scripting Silverlight. And we have an assembly called Microsoft.scripting.extension attribute, which is the bane of my existence. I mentioned that Microsoft Scripting Core is the next version of System Core, right? And that's really true, right? That's when you look at what's in Microsoft Scripting Core, it's things like link expression trees. We've open sourced the link expression tree work from .NET 3.5. But as you can imagine, if you want to build an application that uses Microsoft Scripting Core and System Core, you know, those are two different versions of essentially the same library, and you run into collisions. So we actually rename all of the types in Microsoft Scripting Core so they don't collide. Except we can't rename system.compilerservices.extension attribute, which is what enables extension methods in .NET 3.5. So we had to put that in a separate assembly to try and have scenarios where, like, you can actually build these applications even though there are collisions in their types. It's a real hassle. I'm looking forward to .NET 4. If for no other reason, I'll be able to get rid of that DLL. So all of those assemblies come in when you install IronPython. And IronRuby has a similar set of DLLs that it gets. You also get versions of the DLLs that run on top of the desktop and the Silverlight CLRs. Yes, if you're going to distribute an IronPython application, you need to distribute those DLLs. So I'll give you an example. I recently built an application. There's a library in Python called Pigments for doing color syntax highlighting. So I built an extension for a Windows Live Writer that uses it. So in order to distribute that application, I have all of the parts of the Pigments library, which is all written in Python. I have a few parts of the standard Python class library that Pigments depends on, and then I have IronPython modules and all the DLLs. And when I do the install, I just install all of them onto the disk. So yeah, you do have to have those. Other questions?
IntelliSense, what is the chance to get good IntelliSense in the future? Can they competitors do that?
So what's the chance of getting good IntelliSense? If you look at the tools that are out there now, Wing and PyDev actually do a pretty decent job of IntelliSense for Python objects. They don't do .NET IntelliSense particularly well. Sharp Develop, at least in the what looks like they're doing for 3.1, is punting on IntelliSense for Python files. The IntelliSense in the IronPython Studio or the IronPython example from Visual Studio Extensibility isn't that great, but it's a sample, so they were trying to show how you bring up the IntelliSense window, not here's the definitive way of doing IntelliSense. Clearly doing IntelliSense in Python is a lot harder than doing IntelliSense in, say, C# or VB. Because you can do these weird things at runtime that you can't do in C#. However, you can also do those kind of weird things at runtime in JavaScript, and yet we have pretty decent JavaScript IntelliSense. So I actually am very confident that we'd be able to do a good IntelliSense. We'd be able to do good IntelliSense if we could integrate into Visual Studio. And it's just a question of having the time and resources to do it. We've actually prototyped some stuff out in that space. We just haven't had the time to actually build the full thing. So I'm very confident. It's just a question of getting the time and the money. If anybody here thinks it's a really important thing to get IronPython in Visual Studio, my email address is harry.pearson@microsoft.com. Any anecdotal evidence that I can gather, I will be happy to show to the powers that be in order to try and get more resources to actually build it. And I'm on tape saying that. Isn't that great? No. Other questions? Okay, well, one more.
What does the Iron come from?
Iron stands for it runs on .NET. That's a reverse engineered acronym, I believe. So Jim Huguenin originally created IronPython. This is a funny story. He actually originally created IronPython because at the time that he created it, there was this common belief that the .NET platform was not very good for dynamic languages. Microsoft had actually paid an external company to build Python for .NET, and it ran pretty badly. And they blamed the .NET framework, and so people believed that .NET framework was bad for dynamic languages. Jim Huguenin had actually built the original version of Jython, the version of Java, the version of Python that runs on the Java virtual machine. So he has clearly a lot of experience building Python on top of virtual execution environments. And so he thought to himself, how could Microsoft have screwed this up so badly? So he set out and spent about 6 weeks building out the first prototype of Iron Python so that he could figure out what we had done so wrong and write a small, pithy paper called Why .NET Stinks for .NET for Dynamic Languages. And what he discovered is, of course, that it doesn't, that it's actually extremely fast. And he published his findings, and we wisely hired him. There was a, you know, there might have been a few more steps involved there. But the original version of Jython was actually called JPython. And apparently, and he ran into some kind of, you know, squabble about the name with Sun. And so when he went to go name Iron Python, he wanted to make sure he didn't use any, you know, obviously .NET-y name that would get Microsoft's ire invoked. So he didn't call it, you know, NPython or Python Sharp or Python.NET. And I don't know the methodology behind how he picked Iron, but he did. And then we called Iron Ruby, you know, to match. And then later we decided that it stood for It Runs on .NET. So. No worries. In case since this is on tape, I'll definitely want to say this. I actually had a customer who asked me, well, we're thinking about building an implementation of a language that will remain nameless, and we'd like to call it Iron, that language. Is that going to get Microsoft upset? No, you can call it Iron whatever. We don't care. So, but I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not allowed to give official legal advice. So, I have to say that because it's on tape. So, I spend, as you can imagine, am I from the States? I am from the States, but that's not the reason I have to say that. As you can imagine, being a guy who works on open source projects at Microsoft, I actually spend a insignificant amount of my time talking to lawyers. I've actually become the point person for lawyer discussions in my group. We need some help on the F-sharp team. What do you need? Oh, well, we need some legal help. Let's go ask Harry. He has to do a lot of that lawyer stuff. So I actually have a regular standing biweekly meeting with the lawyers. A lot of it lately has been focused on the CodePlex Foundation, so I'm very excited that that's now public, so we can start driving some of this discussion a little more publicly and maybe distribute it among other members of my team. So, other questions that don't involve anything about lawyers, please, please, please. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming.